think there's a market for optimism. I think there's a market for serious ideas presented in an accessible way, but in depth. So kind of both of those things. So not too boring, hopefully, but, you know, reasonably in depth. And, you know, a market across the political spectrum.
What you heard there was Ed Miliband, former leader of the opposition, talking about why he's now a podcaster. And he's not alone. Politicians across the spectrum, from Nigel Farage to Nick Clegg, are at it too, as are many political journalists, pundits and activists. They have also exploded in popularity. The BBC's Brexit cast once even reached the very top of the iTunes charts, and many others comfortably reached the top 50, week in and week out. My name is Emma Burnell, and I'm a political journalist, podcaster and podcast addict. I wanted to look at why so many people are suddenly making and listening to podcasts on politics right now, and how they're using this medium to better understand and sometimes even influence politics. What is it that people get from podcasts they don't get from other media? I started by asking Nick Robinson, already the presenter of Radio 4's Today programme, why he too had turned to podcasting.
To be candid, when Radio 4 first said, "Will you do a podcast?" I thought, well, why aren't we doing this as a Radio 4 programme? When the idea of doing a sort of one-on-one interview was discussed, and the person in charge said, look, you'll take more risks, you'll be more experimental, you'll learn more, if you haven't got the pressure of it being simultaneously on Radio 4. And podcasting, he said, which I now know but didn't at the time, is different. It's different for reasons you'll know all too well. A different type of person often listens. My kids' generation in particular are podcast addicts. They're in their teens and 20s. It's an in-ear experience rather than fighting the noise of the bath or the bacon frying or the car. And it is narrowcasting in the sense of you choose. It's the Netflix generation. It's the iPlayer generation of people who are choosing to listen to a particular show rather than just having it on and seeing if it's something they like.
Here's Stephen Bush and Helen Lewis of the New Statesman Politics podcast.
I think what you get from podcasting you don't really get from another medium is the ability to have a more conversational take on, in our case, British politics, because you can have a back and forth in a more kind of, maybe I'm saying organic and homespun as code for the fact that we do it in a basement, but I think the kind of appeal of it is perhaps something that television and radio used to do in kind of the era of like two channels, of kind of sort of really chewing over an issue and being sort of more discursive.
So you can say things that are difficult or more controversial or talk through issues. You know, you can talk through issues of race or gender or anti-Semitism, these really difficult topics, because you kind of can't be clipped out and misinterpreted. I know that is technically possible, but it's not a thing that happens all the time, right? It's not like when you say something on Twitter and one bit of the phrasing is kind of picked on and 400 people kind of come in and you just think, well, this is impossible. You can't have a conversation like this. It exists as a discrete unit. But people have to kind of, there is a kind of price to entry of it, of like you have to listen to the whole thing really and absorb that full discussion. So it allows nuance, it allows empathy, it allows humanity and warmth.
Veteran broadcaster and former Conservative candidate Ian Dale now hosts a regular podcast alongside previous Labour Home Secretary Jackie Smith.
It's meant to be a conversation. Somebody said to me the other day that it's like listening to two friends down the pub talking about the week's events. And that's what it's meant to be, because it's not meant to be academic. It's not meant to be particularly serious. We talk about serious subjects. And of course, there are serious conversations that we have. It's not all slapstick humor, but we do introduce humor when we can. Some episodes are funnier than others. Some people might not like our humor at all, in which case they won't listen. But in the end, it's our personalities that people will either like or not. And so far, we've had virtually 100% positive feedback from it.
Jackie Smith, and apologies here for the slight sound problems.
I certainly feel that using my experience, making the arguments that I'm making, doing it with somebody who doesn't automatically share my views, I hope demonstrates to people that there is genuine value in political debate and discussion, that there is, there are genuine people on all sides of politics in a democracy who deserve respect, even if you don't agree with them, and that It is possible to disagree without rancour. And I feel more now that that is necessary, given some of the sort of abuse and general sort of disrespect that politicians and politics faces.
One of the most successful British podcasts is Talking Politics, a weekly show where a group of Cambridge academics discuss a singular issue in depth. I asked host David Runciman why he thought it worked.
So the original goal was to suggest to people that you could have conversations in a university between academics about politics that were accessible and also different from journalists and what you might hear on the Today programme. Maybe more in depth, maybe more historical perspective, more... I mean, the other thought was we're living through a time where politics is interesting to almost everyone, so why not talk to scientists and novelists? And it doesn't have to be politicians, political journalists, commentators. And yeah, it was to show that you could do that in a way that doesn't have to be sort of sound different and elitist, but can be serious. We're very conscious of not trying to be the kind of experts. You know, there are lots of experts, but not because there's anything wrong with experts. It's important not to be the person who's sort of trying to present superior knowledge. So I think when people come across it, if they value it, it's because they feel they get something, you know, they learn something from it, but they're not being sort of preached at. I mean, if we persuade people to think that there's more to this question, that's great. That would be the point, in a way, that there's a question that people have a view on, and then if after 45 minutes of us, they think, not necessarily it's more complicated than that, but there's a kind of range of things that go to make this question what it is. That's great.
Matt Chorley of the Times Red Box podcast.
You want somebody to come away from, even when it's a normal one where we're just having a conversation, you want somebody to come away with a fact or a nugget. Basically, you can show off, you know, you're getting privileged insight that you can't get anywhere else. And so you want people to go, no, I heard this thing on the Red Box podcast. And actually, it's not that, it's that. Or the thing you really ought to be watching is this minister or that policy, which is about to go wrong, and that's the sort of thing the mood that you want to try and get. I think the way that Redbox works, the podcast alongside the email, is a sort of going behind the curtain a bit on what is going on in politics. So what you really want is maybe Sam Coates and the Times lobby team saying, "I can't stop bumping into ministers moaning about X." And then a columnist says, well, I remember this was what it was like under Tony Blair. And then maybe a polling expert or an academic says, well, actually, the public don't care about any of this. It's just, you know, and that sort of coming at one issue from three different directions is the idea.
And it is that balance of insider knowledge and a peek behind the curtain of politics that podcasting seems uniquely to offer. Matt Thord is a comedian and former Labour Party staffer. He now has an interview show called The Political Party, in which he talks to guests, including controversial choices such as George Galloway and Tommy Robinson.
It's never going to be confrontation unless someone says something that is really, you know, that is sort of beyond the pale. And I'm very keen not to treat people differently. I think the principle of the show is that anyone could come on and be treated respectfully. And to some extent, I leave it up to the audience to make their own mind up. I do challenge people. I do ask difficult questions. I think just I choose... It's my natural, you know, conversational style to just try and get on with someone. So sitting down opposite someone and asking them about it is not, it doesn't make you complicit and it doesn't make you enabling at all. I just want to talk to as many different people about politics as possible, and that will occasionally involve talking to controversial people, but the last thing I'd ever want is to be controversial for the sake of it. I hate offending people, even as a comedian. It would be wrong of me to get someone on and change the principle of the show. Equally, it would be wrong to have someone on and not challenge them. So I do challenge people, but I do it in a way that isn't like Newsnight.
Nick Robinson again.
People like me, who have been in and around politics all our lives, since being a student, who are in a sense the focus of the criticism as much as people who are politicians. You're all the same, you're all part of the establishment, you all know each other. We have to ask ourselves some questions about that. Part of what it led me to believe is that there's a sort of depth to politicians, there's a breadth to their lives, there's an interest and humanity in them that never comes out in conventional broadcasting. So to talk to Tom Watson about how he's lost an enormous amount of weight and how he thinks that's changed his personality, to talk to Angela Rayner, the Shadow Education Secretary, about being a single mum at 16 and a grandmother in her 30s, to talk to Emily Thornberry about having to move house from the posh house up the hill to the poor house down the hill and having to sell the cats, or probably have them put down in truth, and she might not have known it as a kid. They tell you something about these people that you don't get in a conventional interview. And they fill out people's character and their motivations. So in that sense, I think that's a good thing.
Clearly, Nick Robinson agrees with Matt on the need to understand politicians a bit more, who they are and what makes them tick, and also on the ability for podcasting as a format to enable that. But do podcasts have other political virtues? Does the depth and style of the discussions help us develop a better political discourse? Podcast producer Caroline Crampton thinks so.
I think what happens is that people come to a particular podcast for its headline position. So, an example, Romaniacs or something. That does what it says on the tin. You come to Romaniacs because you are a Remainer and you want to hear from other people who are Remainers. But maybe three episodes in, as a side note, they start talking about prison reform or something. You don't know a huge amount about it, but you were quite set in your view, but you hear them and you're like, actually, no. So I think that's how minds get changed, because I think people initially come to the podcast for its main topic, then, because a lot of political podcasts are discussion shows, they range a bit more widely than that, so they cover other topics. And I think once people are caught by a personality and a format that they like, they'll stick with it, even if there are some things that happen that they weren't previously totally okay with.
Helen Lewis agrees.
I think if anything's going to change your mind, it would be a podcast, because you would hear reasonable levels of disagreement, right? And it would model productive disagreement. And one of the things I think is most important that you do on a podcast is when you have you sort of model what it's like to disagree on an issue and still talk to the other person at the other side, which is something that social media is particularly bad at. And like, here's what it means to be ideologically opposed but not personally vicious.
However, Stephen Bush has concerns.
One of the political problems of our time is that, you know, the last time anyone won a parliamentary majority in this country was before the invention of iPlayer, and actually midway through the Freeview rollout. So there was a much more tightly controlled political, not necessarily controlled debate, but a much more controlled and restricted arena. Now you have a situation where, with the exception of a kind of hyper-engaged slither of our audience who listens to our podcast, The Spectator's podcast, The Economist podcast, a lot of people are effectively choosing their bunker. The kind of the trend of politics for everyone to retreat into silos, right? Well, it's lucrative to just pick a silo and service it, right? That is, you know, kind of the rational interest of any media organization is to find a silo, because actually even the OI detached centrist silo is still a silo. And I don't think it's good for discourse that we increasingly all exist in political silos.
David Runciman.
The advantage that we have, so we're not coming at it like even a magazine with a political standpoint, but also we're not the BBC, we don't have to be balanced. I mean, that's the great thing, is that we can be sort of a range of political opinions, but we can be really opinionated. Whereas to do the equivalent on the BBC, I don't think we could, even what we do, which is pretty mild, would be thought to be unbalanced.
By their very nature, podcasts are discursive. And that largely means they're opinionated. But do they have to be? Political Thinking is a very personal, in-depth podcast showcasing the lives, thoughts, influences, and occasionally even ambitions of politicians and leading political thinkers. But while it may showcase the thoughts of others, it does not do so for those of its host, for a reason. Nick Robinson.
Having broadcasting that you can trust, that sets out to be impartial, made not by people who are this miraculous thing that they have no views, there are no such people that exist, but made by people who come to work saying it is not our job to propagate our views, it is not our job to choose the facts that suit us, it's our job to try and get as close as we can to the truth on that day, and if we get it wrong, to correct it. That is very important, yes. It's hard to understand that this value of being impartial is a real value, but also there is a genuine sort of pride in saying, not just a pride in doing it, but a belief that it is valuable, and that there are downsides to impartiality. Sometimes it can feel like it splits the difference. Sometimes people allege it produces false balance. Sometimes it can feel too cautious. There are all sorts of potential downsides. But the idea that there should be some shared facts that you can then have a debate about, rather than as we increasingly have, where there are no facts at all, or it's alleged there are no facts, because even the President of the United States can simply make things up. That is not healthy.
Despite podcasting with a former leader of the opposition, Jeff Lloyd argues that if they're trying to persuade people, it's on issues, not party politics.
A reason it's been surprising, though, is something that we, because we're a podcast, we don't have to do that, you have to do in broadcast, is show any kind of balance. So when we talk about these ideas, I mean, we ask a lot of questions, but what we're not doing is getting somebody with an opposing view and getting them to squabble it out, which a lot of broadcast media does. So in a way, there's a lack of balance. So that makes it slightly surprising to me that it has gained this following from
well, it's kind of advocacy, but without partisanship, I think.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's just really not trying to do Yaboo sucks to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So now Ed Miliband and Jackie Smith aren't at the forefront of the Labour Party anymore. What is it that they want to achieve by podcasting?
World domination. I think the sort of the best answer I can give is try to advance ideas that can tackle the things I care about, like inequality and so on, try and get them to a wider audience and try to sort of get change to happen that way. And the podcast is one vehicle for doing it, basically. Getting used to that freedom and how I use that freedom is a sort of evolving process, definitely.
You haven't got as much power or influence as a podcaster as you have as the Home Secretary or any of the other ministerial roles that I held. But one of the things about being an elected politician, particularly in a senior position like that, is that, of course, you're pretty constrained in what you can say. And you are bound rightly by collective responsibility. You tend to become defensive. You are recorded and you work in sound bites. So all of those things. I mean, the irony is that being a podcaster is rather more like the type of things that brought you into politics in the first place, which is, you know, lengthy discussions with friends and others about political ideas. That's what gets you interested in politics in the first place. And then you lose quite a lot of that when you're actually doing the nitty-gritty of government. And one of the liberations of no longer doing that, is being able to get back to thinking about ideas, arguing with people, expressing views, expressing doubts, for example, exploring ideas at a longer length. And that's what you can do. That's what I can do now that I couldn't do when I was in, when I was actually in office.
But others see podcasting as a vital weapon in their partisan armoury. Mark Wallace is one of the rotating hosts of Mogcast, Conservative Home's podcast focused on Jacob Rees-Mogg. And Matt Zarb-Cousin is co-host of All the Best, a podcast on the Corbyn-supporting Novara Media Network.
I don't share Jacob's views on faith, and I don't share a variety of his views on social issues. We actually probably share a view that the state ought not to be the person, or not to be enforcing those enforcing those views or not. But I and a lot of other Tories enjoy hearing somebody who simply says what they do actually think. Yeah, I don't think there's a huge amount of veiling going on there, which clearly appeals to people.
There isn't really like a left-wing like podcast that's kind of not mainstream as such, but like accessible, I think. It's like a lot of the left is very intellectualised and we're kind of more left populist, I think. So if you were like not really attuned to political discourse or anything and you listened to our podcast, the idea is that you would be able to understand, you know, what we were talking about. It's ambitious, but we want to like offer something that has the capacity or the potential to break out of the bubble. I think there's two aspects to it. It's like political education, which is really, really important on the left, because I think there's a tendency to, well, I just think we just take it for granted in the Labour Party why people are members. You know, we don't really provide any kind of ideological framework to what it means to be a Labour member. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is an analysis of what's happening, and a left analysis, and arming people with the arguments, and hopefully we do that. People that come up to me say, you know, really, really enjoy it, and it's really, like, valuable.
As you have heard, there is a huge variety of approaches to political podcasting, from the academic and analytic to the political and polemic, and some are somewhere in between. Each offers different insights into our extraordinary political moment. Podcasts, especially those which covered politics, took a while to take off. The medium has been around now for well over a decade. Perhaps, though, it took a renewed taste for political discussion, aligned with the technology to access that on the go, at any time, to ensure that political podcasting came into its own. What is clear is that audiences and podcasters alike feel they are getting something from the medium they don't get elsewhere. Something crunchier, something more in-depth. As long as that remains, and our appetite to tune in as those we trust try to make sense of the times we find ourselves in, political podcasting will continue to flourish.